You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast, and you're about to hear how a dude who risks his life for a living stays mentally and physically tough enough to, well, do exactly that. Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party so you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollock. Now let's get this party started. This episode is sponsored by Genexa, the extremely cool organic medicine company whom you heard from the founder of in episode 44. Genexa has a line of 11, one better than the next, homeopathic medicines that work with your body to rid itself of anything from a cold to allergies to sleeplessness to stress to muscle pain and to jet lag. And when I say they work with your body, I mean exactly that, because that's what homeopathic medicine is. It's medicine that utilizes plants, like a passion flower in the case of Genexa's stress relief formula, to kind of remind our body of its ability to work properly. And in the case of the passion flower, it tells our mind to quiet down and it instructs our nerves to chill the F out. Because Genexa's medicines don't have anything toxic or terrible in them, there are zero side effects, which is sweet. Also sweet is that as a Party in My Plants podcast listener, you can save 30% off any Genexa products that you want to buy off their site, genexahealth.com, using code PARTYPLANTS. And if this was just way too much to remember and you're now stressed and got to go buy their stress relief formula, go to the show notes, partyinmyplants.com/47 for all this info. So I actually met today's guest on the subway. He was fiddling with some handcuffs, you know, practicing his act. And I asked him what he was doing. I learned that he was a professional daredevil stunt performer who's done everything from hanging from a building with just two fingers to flipping cars to getting attacked by a shark purposely to hanging to a burning rope just by his teeth on one of my favorite shows, America's Got Talent. I just knew that Jonathan Goodwin had to come on the show to share his perspective on mental toughness, focus, and discipline. Okay, all that is totally true, except we didn't meet on the subway. The subway would actually be more believable than the way we actually met. We actually met on stage at the Palace Theater on Broadway in New York in front of 1,800 people when Jonathan randomly pulled me out of the audience and onto the stage to perform a stunt with him. And by stunt, I mean I had to hold a flower horizontally by my teeth, which, by the way, is way harder than it might seem. You try it. And Jonathan, blindfolded, used a whip to chop that flower in half without chopping me in half, too. Needless to say, he and I would not be talking today if I had any scars to prove this. But I do have a video to prove this, which you can watch at partyinmyplants.com/47. Okay, so it's time to abracadabra. Make my chat with the amazing danger man, Jonathan Goodwin, appear. Jonathan, you are the coolest. Thank you so much for taking time out of swallowing scorpions or something to chat with me today.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, so just right off the bat, how would you describe what you do?
So I am I'm a daredevil stunt performer. And usually, you know, in this day and age, that means somebody who's sponsored by an energy drink. But, you know, 100 years ago, the people that were doing that kind of thing were usually performers. And They were doing stunts not for their own ego, but they were doing it, you know, to create a theatrical experience for an audience or to promote a theater show, and so a lot of the stunts that, you know, that you would see back then are very much more theatrical than today. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's the closest thing to what I do. You know, it's recreating that world for a modern audience.
Yes. I mean, I love that you call yourself a theatrical stunt performer, because that is exactly right. I mean, well done. I mean, because you have that incredible theatrical talent, like the performance part of the equation where you can learn the audience and speak to us and really keep us hanging on the edge of our seat and really like fall in love with you on the stage. But then you have the stunts, like lying shirtless on a bed of nails. I mean, a bed of one nail. So how did you get into all this?
So I read a book about Harry Houdini when I was 7 years old. And that was kind of that. You know, I guess like any seven-year-old, I was fascinated with the character of, you know, of a superhero. But the thing about Houdini that was different to all of the other superheroes was that he was real. You know, he really did the things that I read about. Yeah. And once I realized that you could actually do that for a job, I never really wanted to do anything else. And so I practiced, you know, I would, you know, practice holding my breath in the bath, and I'd get my dad to like tie me up and see if I could escape. And I sort of went about learning all of the different skills that I thought I needed. And I did it really diligently until I was probably about 14 or 15, and then, you know, discovered other things. For a while I wanted to be an actor, and I sort of did that. I went to theater school in London and trained and did all of that stuff. But it never really resonated with me as much as the performing side of what I do. And so after a while, I sort of went full circle and came back to where I started and took it maybe a bit more seriously than I had done before and decided to make a career out of it.
Yeah, I'd say you take it very seriously. What do your parents think about it now?
They still are waiting for me to get a proper job, I think. although maybe they're not holding their breath now. They'll come and see the theater show. I do a stunt, not in the show that you saw, I think, but in another. You know, I have a huge amount of different material that I do, and one of the things that I do is I escape from a straitjacket when I'm hanging upside down. But that straitjacket and myself, I'm completely on fire. So I have to escape from the straitjacket, grab a fire extinguisher, and put myself out. And when my parents came to see that theater show, my mum couldn't watch that.
Really?
No. Yeah, and even though she knows that, you know, I know what I'm doing and that, you know, knock on wood, I'm going to be okay. Yeah, she couldn't. She had to look away. She couldn't watch.
I love that knock on wood, I'm going to be okay, because how do you go into these performances where your life is really on the line and feel confident that you're going to come out of it, knock on wood, okay? Like, how does that work for you every day that you perform?
It's practice, and training is the truth. Within the sort of my work world, the audience gets to see about 3% of what I do. You know, that the performance part of it is just the very top of the iceberg, if you know what I mean. And so, you know, before I'm going to try something and actually risk my life, you know, doing it as just even the first time, let alone putting it on stage in front of an audience, there's a huge amount of R&D and research and preparation and training that goes into what I do before I get there. So, you know, I don't know. I do a stunt with crossbows. I'm a marksman, so I shoot on stage.
Yeah.
And I do a stunt where I have six bows on stands, and they're all of them have a target attached to the trigger of the crossbow, and they're all aimed at themselves. So it's like a chain reaction. You make the first shot and hit the first target, and then all of the crossbows go off in about 1.5 seconds. It's very, very quick. And the last crossbow is aiming at me. And so I have to catch the arrow before it hits me. That's kind of the bit.
Like catch it with your hand?
Yeah. And so that from having the idea to working on it really diligently and consistently to be able to put it on stage and actually perform it was 3 years.
Wow. A 2 second performance act.
Yeah. I mean, it's 3 minutes because basically you see the whole process in order for people to really understand what's going to happen. They have to see it set up. So it's done to that part of it is done to music, and you see me and it's actually my wife on stage with me, setting aiming the crossbows, and loading the arrows, and so that you get every aspect of it before it happens.
Wow. So 3 years goes into that, like 3 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you, persevere through that? Like, that is such a long time to not really, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the gratifying part of that is the performance, right? To hear and see people's response and their jaws drop and their applause. So for those 3 years, how do you persist without that, like, instant gratification?
Because I know I'm going to get there. And it wasn't 3 years until it worked. It was 3 years until I was ready to do it in front of an audience. Basically how that worked is the bows shoot at about 120 feet per second. So it's very, very quick and far quicker than you can react. So even if I wait until the bow, if I wait until the bow fires, it's too late. It already hit me. And so that's the reason that we have six. I'm actually not reacting to the bow that fires an arrow at me. I'm reacting to the third one in the chain. And so the process was that I strapped, I made a little target and I strapped it to my chest. And I had my wife shoot me over and over and over and over again.
Oh, how romantic.
Yeah, exactly. We have no arguments in our house. And then it was just about, training it till it became second nature, till I don't have to think about it anymore. I just know when to go,
Wow. And so do you, you have multiple stunts that you're working on at one time. So how do you balance the practice for each of them? And do each of your stunts require, up to 3 years of practice to get it, really confidently ready for a stage?
No. Some of them are really quick, and I'm British, so I don't like blowing my own trumpet or tooting my own horn. But I'm a very quick study, so there are some things that I have been able to just pick up and do. It's funny, and I shouldn't tell you this, but the bullwhip stunt that we did on stage.
Yeah, tell me. Yep.
Probably no more than about 2 hours. No. Actually,
seriously, that's because you weren't really wearing a blindfold. It was a fake blindfold, right?
No. It's a real blindfold.
Joking. You put it on me.
It's a real blindfold, but it keys into other things that I've done that I already have. Like a bullwhip is actually very, very similar in its principles to knife throwing, and I've been knife throwing for years. So the targeting aspect of it is the same, and I shoot crossbows blindfolded as well. Wow. So I'm very familiar with that spatial awareness, and so actually that stunt, the bullwhip stunt is easy. It was not a complicated thing for me to learn at all. So it really depends on what the challenge is.
Right. I mean, they all look, well, I guess they don't all look equally. I'm sure, you being buried alive looks more risky than whipping me, because how does that work? Like, is there a chance you could have mistakenly whipped me? Like, if I had moved by mistake or something? I mean, I had that hard time keeping my flower up. So was that, like, what do you feel when you bring innocent people into your stunts? Are you extra scared that you could injure them?
No, because I would be, it's the same as doing something for me. I wouldn't do it if I thought that I was going to injure you. And there are protocols that you would not have been aware of to keep you safe. Like if you had moved forwards, which is obviously the dangerous area in front of you, there was a person ready to step in to stop me and step in and move you back to the right position. So the variations of, the nuances of that, I'm putting that bullwhip, I because of the way I position you and because of the position that I stand in, I'm putting that bullwhip off the end of the flower and then moving it in incrementally, basically by probably about a quarter of an inch is the tolerance. And it's a reasonably long flower. So actually, from that point of view, you're pretty safe.
I was pretty safe. I was the safest one in the room.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that, but you were pretty safe.
So it sounds like you have to really be, you know, like an engineer to come up with all this stuff.
Yeah, it's really important, and you have to know about a lot of things. You know, physics and engineering is really key to what I do. Wow. Especially in the bigger things, you know, when you set yourself on fire, you know, there's an awful lot of thermodynamics and all of that sort of stuff that goes into it. And, yeah, all sorts of different things. Wow. Every new stunt has a ton of new challenges.
Yeah. And that must be so fun for you, keeping you on your toes, off your toes, off the air.
Yeah.
Literally. How do you come up with your stunts?
Lots of different ways, really. I get my influence from performers from the past and movies and, you know, harebrained schemes. My wife actually quite often comes up with a lot of the really dangerous things. I don't know whether she's... Yeah, I don't know whether she's just really into it or whether she's harboring under the misapprehension that I'm very well insured. I don't know.
That's so interesting. That's so funny. It's so cool you guys work together.
Yeah, yeah. Katie's super creative. She is. She was a television producer. She's actually a hypnotist by profession now. But she was a television producer, and I worked a lot in television, so that's how we met. And so she has a really good eye for what's going to be an effective stunt. And we, you know, she's really a sounding board for me. I'll pitch her and say, you know, what about this? What do you think about that? And you know, sometimes she'll say, yeah, that's great. And other times she'll go, no, back to the drawing board, Baldy. That's
Baldy. I mean, that sounds like your perfect soulmate. I mean, yeah, how many people are you going to find that's, you know, going to be your sounding board for these crazy daredevil stunts?
Totally. And I've done what I do for a long time. And it's actually, you know, in the past, it's been a thing that it's been a problem, you know, in past girlfriends and whatnot, you know, people got genuinely upset and scared by what I do. And it became a problem in the relationship. Katie knew what I did before, even before we met, actually. She knew who I was before we met. So, she came into it with her eyes open.
Yeah, I get scared when my boyfriend Jesse rides a city bike through New York City and doesn't tell me. He has to check
really
in with
dangerous.
Me because I'm scared that he's going to get hit. So have a pack where we don't ride without the other one. That's me. So yeah. I would not be a perfect fit for a daredevil.
I'm with you. That's, you know, my job is all about controlling variables. About, you know, taking something that seems very risky and probably is risky, but being able to control all of the different variables that happen so that I can control the outcome. And riding a city bike through New York, there are more variables than you could possibly ever control. That's really scary.
Oh, well, thank you. I feel comfortable.
You're welcome.
So do you ever get scared?
Sometimes, but I can control it. I don't like heights, and I've done lots of things where I've been really high.
Yeah, I've seen you hang off a building with two fingers on each hand.
Yeah.
What? How high was that building? It was very tall.
It was about 400 feet high.
You're afraid of heights.
Yeah, I am afraid of heights. I never once looked down. And obviously, and actually working with Katie, there are lots of techniques that you know, that we have that she's helped me with. Being able to compartmentalize all of that, because the psychology of what I do is a very big part of it. You know, being able to stay calm and go through your checklist as you're doing these kind of things is really important, because if you get that kind of stuff wrong, then it can, you know, things can go wrong very quickly.
Like your checklist of how to position everything to the like perfect angle and make sure everything's set up.
And also, you know, if I'm doing an escape stunt or a stunt, I have, if you allow yourself to sort of think about all of the different things at once, it can be very overwhelming. But what I do is I have like a little checklist. The technique is called chunking. You basically break down your challenge into little bite-sized pieces and you check them off one at a time. So you have to put them in order. And so as you're going through whatever it is, first I've got to do this, and then I've got to do that, and then after that I've got to do that. And so I'm just concentrating on little aspects of it, you know, one at a time. And before you know it, you've done the last one, and the stunt's over.
Wow.
That kind of piecemeal focus, it can be really important, because the other thing is if you put those things in the wrong order, or you allow yourself to get overwhelmed by the bigger picture, then you can get into trouble really easily.
Wow. Do you apply this to life too? I mean, this sounds really calming and like a really useful way to navigate just stressful things in our everyday lives.
We do it already. It's a common technique, but it can be applied to lots of things. Like when you remember we don't do it so much these days, but if you have to remember like a telephone number, for example, you don't remember the whole number. You break it down into like three digits, four digits.
Right.
That's right. So much easier than trying to remember the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it's useful for lots of things. It's really useful for learning skills. Like if you were learning the piano, for example, you know, you don't try and play the whole piece of music. You break it down into chunks and practice those. And then actually in piano, it's a really good, a lot of people do that anyway. They'll break it down. But one of the things that they do is that they always start at the beginning. And so you get really, really good at the first section of a piece of music. And then you stop every time you make a mistake and you go back to the beginning. Well, you know, the problem with that is that you are not practicing in a balanced and even
way. You're just playing the beginning a million times.
Yeah. So you need to break the thing down into chunks and rearrange the order and give an equal amount of practice to all of those sections so that you learn the whole thing at once, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Wow. That's really cool to think about. I would not think that you in these moments are, because you're performing. So it seems like you're literally like talking to us and entertaining us. So it's amazing that at the same time, you could be kind of doing this mental process behind closed doors, you know?
Well, that's the difference. That's the difference between practice, rehearsal, and performance. And those are three very separate things. So practice is when you allow yourself to be super vulnerable. You're learning a thing. You're preparing. You do it in a safe environment where it's okay for you to make a mistake without critical consequences. And then once you've done your practice, then you get into the rehearsal, so that you're putting all of that together. And that's, you know, still a stage where I'm going to be thinking about all of those chunks and the order and all of the things that I was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then performance is once you've got that rehearsal down and all of those mental processes become second nature.
Right.
When I'm on stage, I'm not thinking about that. Yeah, I have to practice and rehearse so that when I'm on stage, I can concentrate on performing.
Right. And then the performance, when you say you concentrate on performing, that means just what does that mean? Because I feel like that would mean thinking about what you have to do, but you're saying that becomes second nature. So when you say concentrate on performing, what does that mean?
Really depends on what the stunt is. But one of the challenges, and this is the same challenge for any performer, is that what I'm doing, I've done so much that it's second nature, that I'm more than familiar with it. But at the same time, I'm conveying it to you for the very, very first time.
Yes.
So when I'm performing it, I have to get myself in a frame of mind which allows me to hear and think about what I'm saying like I'm saying it for the very first time.
Right.
And you know, when you do that effectively, that's the moment that all of the jokes are going to land properly, and the whole thing is explained effectively. And it, you know, especially doing what I'm doing right now, I'm on a massive theater tour. So I'm touring America and I'm doing basically the same routines night after night after night after night.
Wow.
I've been on the road and away from home since November, and I'm running right the way through to the end of April. And so it's very, very easy to just go on to autopilot, because I don't have to think about the words that I say. It's very easy to go on to autopilot and just, you know, dial it in, basically.
Mm.
And so the job, really, because I don't have to concentrate so hard on the task, the job is staying in the moment and making sure that the audience is engaged. You know, that's the challenge.
Wow, you have so many challenges. I mean, I thought just the daredevil-y stunts were the challenge, but there's so many challenges. And it's funny, it's interesting that you say that because, no offense to David Copperfield, but I saw him perform a few years ago in Vegas and it felt like he was just phoning it in. Like he made a car disappear from stage and he made it seem, he was like, all right, now I'm going to make a car disappear from stage. The same way as he was like, all right, now I'm going to do the dishes. And I was not impressed, which he made a car disappear from the stage, but I was not impressed because of the delivery. Cause I guess how many times has he made a car disappear on stage? His delivery made it so uneventful.
Well, the thing about, you know, certainly what I do is that just doing a stunt is sort of not massively interesting. I mean, there is a level of, you know, oh, that was vaguely, you know, that was impressive or whatever. But in order that it's effective, you really have to make people care.
Yeah.
And in order to make people care, they kind of have to like you. Now, if I'm asking an audience to care whether or not I live or die, then they have to sort of like me at the beginning.
Yeah, we want you to live. You want us to totally. Want you to live.
and I think that it's also a big challenge with what I do because you know, it's very difficult to give people a point of reference because what I do is so far out of people's normal everyday.
Right.
Experiences that it's really hard to get people to kind of have a level of empathy or understanding with my, you know, desire to set myself on fire or whatever that might be.
Or lie in one nail.
Yeah, totally. It's a pretty alien thing.
Yeah.
And so that is sort of the big challenge is, you know, how do you do this and make people care?
Wow.
And it's about, you know, there are lots of different ways, you know, where, you know, bringing members of the audience up on stage is, for me, is a really, really useful device because, and although they can't really empathize with me, they can empathize with you standing there with a flower in your mouth.
Literally. So
they know what that might feel like and what they might feel like, and they'll be rooting for you.
Mm.
So, you know, there's lots of different devices that you can use in order to create that kind of connection and empathy.
Right.
You know, it's much more difficult when you're trying to sell Jeopardy than it is if you're trying to make someone laugh.
Mm, yeah, because that's another thing you do. In addition to all this, you're humorous. You make people laugh. I mean, you literally have every single thing going for you that you do on stage. It's amazing. And one of those things is also, you know, being ripped, having a hunky bod. So, I mean, I'm sure in addition to just, you know, the look, your fitness is literally vital for your life, your survival through these trick, I mean, these stunts, right? I mean, you need to be fit and strong in order to pull through.
Yeah, and it's the difference between, you know, in a lot of what I do, it's the difference between me being injured or not, you know, being able to, the show that you saw is a really good example because I was hanging from my teeth in that show.
20 feet in the air.
And if I'm not in good condition doing that, then I'm really gonna hurt myself. I mean, it hurts anyway, but
really?
I'm gonna end up, you know, getting injured. And so I train a lot.
Yeah. It's so what does that look like? What is your fitness routine? Like, give us a little glimpse. And also first, I didn't realize that you're actually ever in pain. I mean, no shit. Of course you're in pain. You're hanging from your teeth. But at the same time, I guess my mind's like, oh, he must not be in pain because if he was in pain, why would he do it? So answer that. I don't get it. You just like the pain.
No, I don't like the pain. It sucks. I'm not going to lie. But it's just one of those things where I'm fascinated with that stunt and I haven't finished with it yet. I'm going to do – I, I'm I'm going to do it live at some point, and I want to do it like on television or maybe on the internet, actually. I want to do like a zip line.
Oh, cool. I mean,
like,
crazy.
Like that. Yeah, I think would be amazing. But it's really interesting to me because it's one of those things where, to me, it's fascinating that the human body can do that. And also, it is a real mental exercise because anybody can do that. It takes a certain amount of physical strength to do it, but your jaw is basically the strongest muscle in your body. Hmm. So it isn't about the bite force. We have it. All of your neck muscles are basically in play there because all of your weight is on your neck, on the back of your neck. Because you're being picked up by your teeth, your neck has to be basically at a 90-degree angle to your spine. So all of your weight has to go around the back of the top of your spine.
I'm biting my pen right now to try to visualize this.
Yeah. So basically, if you're sitting in a chair and put, you know, basically what you have to do, put the pen in your teeth.
It's there.
And then pull your head back until the pen is pointing straight up.
Right.
So that is the position that your neck is in.
Yeah, I feel it.
Now imagine all of your weight going around the back of your neck.
Oh, my God. No. Yeah. So that's what really hurts is the neck.
Yeah, it's the back of your neck. So, yeah, for me, it was, and that, you know, that was one of those things where I pitched that as an idea for a TV spot, actually. And quite often in this situation, what happens is I come up with a daft idea. Somebody asks me to do something. I'll go, well, why don't we do this? And more often than not, they'll, you know, it won't happen for whatever reason. And occasionally those things do happen. And my reaction is always the same. It's like, yes, they want to do it. Damn, they want to do
no.
it. You
know?
But from a standing start, I learned to hang from my teeth in about 2 weeks. And it was really intensive. And I'm very pig-headed. It was basically a battle of will over pain to be able to kind of get there and do it.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a question I had. I mean, you mentioned the mental stuff when you were talking about, you know, breaking things down into chunks. But in terms of, you know, mental strength, I mean, how much of this is mind over matter or, you know, versus like physical, you know, fitness? Like how much of it is fitness and how much of that trick, I guess, or any trick is mental determination and, like you said, like choosing mind over, you know, the pain.
Depends what it is. But right. as a rule of thumb, probably 60-40. 60 mental, 40
wow.
physicality. It's a lot of it is mental for sure. But having said that, the physical aspect of it is very important.
And right.
My body is my living, and so if I get injured, then I'm stuffed. So
yeah.
So it's really important, you know, to train.
To keep both in shape. I mean, so for your mind,
yeah.
What do you do? I mean, do you meditate? Are there any books that you've read that really have given you a wonderful mindset shift? Like what do you do to, I guess, exercise your mind?
Yeah, all of that comes from my wife.
Really?
All of that comes
from hypnotherapy.
From Katie and yeah, I mean not so much. I mean, hypnotherapy is a word that I'm not particularly fond of, but she has taught me a lot of mental exercises and tricks that I use in my work. And a lot of it, it's funny, you know, positive thinking is, a lot of people get a real, you know, the idea that in having a positive and progressively positive outlook on a task or challenge, a lot of people find it hard to accept that a mental attitude like that can have an effect physiologically on your body. And a lot of people think, oh well, that's, you know, that's woo woo, that can't be real. But we have no problem accepting the opposite is true, that anxiety, for example, can have a physical effect on your body.
Yeah.
You know, sweaty palms, you know, you need to go to the bathroom.
Shallow breathing.
You know, all of those sort of things. It's really easy to accept that negative thoughts can affect us physiologically, that people don't tend to think about how positive thoughts and focus can affect us in a positive way. And that's, you know, that's what Katie does.
Maybe I have to bring her on the show.
Oh, I'm sure. She would love it, actually.
Okay, that would be great. So what do you do to stay healthy and fit on the road? Do you have any tricks or tips that you can share about how to stay consistent with, you know, a clean diet and your fitness routine while always traveling?
Yeah, most of the hotels that we go to have a reasonably like a basic gym. You know, you're going to find weights up to 50 pounds and a bench and usually like a yoga ball, and if you're lucky there'll be a cable machine and a treadmill. And that's okay. You know, I can get by in that situation. Really, though, my salvation in training are resistance bands.
Oh,
they're fantastic. And there are a lot of things, you know, a lot of the time, and I was really guilty of this for the longest time too, that, you know, that I always thought, well, there's no way that you can get a decent workout with that, because, you know, it's basically, you know,
it's no weight. Yeah.
Well, how much resistance can you possibly get?
From a
rubber band.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking right now I know how big your muscles are, and I'm like, how does he use a resistance band? He must be lifting really heavy weights.
Well, there's two things. The first is that you want to get a set of resistance bands that are stackable. So instead of a permanent handle on the end of the band, you have a clip, and the handles are separate. So you can add multiple bands to one handle.
Oh.
And the set that I have goes up to about 120 pounds.
Oh.
And so from that point of view, there really isn't a compromise to be made.
Wow.
You know, in what your gym routine is. I can get a really good, uncompromising full body workout in my hotel room. I don't even need to go to the gym. Yeah, they're really good. And the great thing about them is they, you know, pack up in a little bag. The whole thing weighs about a pound.
Yeah.
So it's not going to add to your luggage.
Cool.
And yeah, they're really great. I heartily recommend all of those. That's a really good tip.
That's a really good tip. That's great. And what about, you know, going on all these airplanes? I mean, for me, when I fly, it takes a little bit of a recovery period after even just like a 6-hour flight or a 3-hour flight. You know, you feel kind of gross. You're bloated from the, you know, the food and the, you know, the altitude and all the pressure and all that stuff. Like, it's a really unpleasant experience. So I'm sure you've had times where you've flown and then maybe have even performed later that day.
Sure.
Like, how do you do that? How do you recover so quickly? Do you have any tricks for flying healthily on an airplane?
Well, I think all of that is about, I mean, my tips for like traveling and flying are sleep as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whenever I'm on an airplane, I don't, you know, there are some people that are like, oh no, I'm going to stay up and watch a movie, or I'm going to, you know, I'll just, you know, sit and read or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I consider that sort of always mental recovery time. So I'm going to just go to sleep, basically. And that way, whenever I get off the plane, I'm going to feel better than I would have if I was just sitting there the whole time. I think it's about drinking a lot of water. I very rarely eat airplane food.
Yeah.
So I'm going to either bring my own food or depending on the flight, I'll eat ahead of time, you know. And the good thing about, you know, compared to most places in the world, the good thing about America is that more often than not, you can go into a restaurant and you can get your meal how you want it cooked.
Right.
You know, if you want to supplement something or take something away, or, you know, not have cheese or whatever that might be, people are like, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
In you know, where I'm from in the UK, if you ask for that, people will look at you strangely.
Like it's inappropriate?
It's just not how, you know, that's a massive inconvenience.
So you're a burden, high maintenance, a diva.
Exactly. And that isn't the case in the States.
No.
Anyway, really, you can go. I love it. It's fantastic. It's actually really easy for me to eat healthily on the road. It's just about, you know, it's actually about the mental exercise and the willpower and to just make sure that you order the good thing and not the crappy thing.
So for you, what is the good thing versus the crappy thing?
As in, what is my diet?
Yeah.
I
lots of plants, lots of fruits and veggies.
I don't eat fruit.
Oh.
Yeah. It's an awful lot of sugar.
Okay. Why are you not a fan of sugar?
Because it's just not good for you.
Okay.
Simple as that. There's enough fat in the way that food is usually prepared that I try not to eat food with additional fat. So I won't have cheese and I won't have butter and I won't have, you know, I'll avoid protein sources that are rich in fat too. Mm. So, you know, steak and red meat and stuff like that. I very seldomly eat. Plants, you know, veggies as much as I can muster. That's all to the good.
Mm-hmm.
But from the point of view of like, you know, maintaining lean body mass, avoiding sugar and avoiding fat are the two big things.
Gotcha. What's your favorite veggie?
Do you know what? It really depends on my mood. I love like if I'm gonna have steamed veggies, if there's some good like bok choy or something like that in there, that's always a winner because it's really hearty and chunky and you feel like you're getting a good meal.
Yeah.
Quite often I'll do like a bolognese type meal and I'll sub in spaghetti squash for noodles.
Yes.
And that I find super, super hearty and good.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, that's a great and satisfying meal.
That is
so
great.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of my veggies. There isn't really anything that I don't eat like that. That's the filler upper for me. That's the thing that I'm not going to deny myself is, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah, the plants, the veggie plants.
Yeah, for sure.
And in terms of keeping your immunity strong, because I mean, you don't have an understudy, right? Like, it's not like you're in The Lion King and anyone else can just play Mufasa. Like, you are the act. So yeah. How do you keep your immune system strong so you don't have any, knock on wood, sick days?
Do you know what? I don't know. Oh. Like, there isn't anything that I'm like consciously doing. I don't particularly believe in vitamins supplements like that. and I don't really take medication. Like, my wife is Katie gets headaches. Katie had scoliosis when she's a kid, and she gets quite a lot of headaches. And so Katie quite often will take, the moment she gets a headache, she'll take Excedrin.
Mm.
And I, you know, and that's fine and that works for her, but I'm not a big believer. It takes an awful lot for me to take medication.
Well, I mean, you're so used to pain.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I don't get freaked out by sort of, especially these days, there are a lot of people that are like super germophobic and they go everywhere with like and I apologize if this is you, but like they go everywhere with like a little bottle of hand sanitizer.
No, I don't use hand sanitizer.
And
only if I'm traveling.
And I'm not that way at all. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm like a dirt
rubbing your face
person.
In dirt.
Yeah, exactly. But I just don't, you know, I don't get freaked out by any of those things. And knock on wood, I don't get sick. Like, I cannot remember the last time I had like a sick day.
Wow.
It will have been years and years and years ago because it just doesn't happen to me.
Well, I wonder if it's, I mean, you have a clean diet and, you know, I think, not that I know for certain, but your mental game is so on point. I mean, it sounds like just from talking to you now, you're such a calm guy and you don't seem like you have a lot of stress, and if you do have stress, it seems like you're really, really good at managing it. And I, you know, they say that stress is the worst thing for us, and it sounds like, I mean, if you can be literally on a building hanging by four fingers, two on each hand, and you have a fear of heights and you can do that, then it sounds like you're pretty good at using your mind to fight through anything. And so it sounds like, in my opinion, from just talking to you, that you really have a great handle on stress. And maybe that could be why.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably multiple things. I mean, it annoys my wife. It was really funny just before we came to New York, where we had a house full of people, and everybody, literally everybody in the house got sick, like unpleasantly sick. Oh. Like people were like vomiting. And all of the rest. Jeez. And it literally went through the house. Like first one person, and then, you know, maybe a couple of hours later, somebody else, somebody else, somebody else. Oh, and we had like six or seven people in the house, and I was fine. Okay.
Then you're just a freak of nature.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. but maybe I was the carrier. Maybe I was like the monkey. Maybe. Outbreak. I don't know. But it was weird. I can't explain. Really weird. I don't know.
That. All right. Well, we'll just leave it as I don't know then. So before I let you go, I really just got to ask, what's one or two of your most favorite stunts that you've ever performed?
Oh, it's tough. What are my favorite stunts? I enjoy the body burn fire straitjacket. That was cool. Oh, no, I know what it is.
Okay.
This was the best thing that I ever did.
Okay.
I did a Discovery Channel special, which was... they came to me because what they wanted to do was they wanted to look at what were statistically the five stupidest things to do in shark-infested water with the specific aim of seeing how difficult it is to be bitten by a shark.
To calm people down, to show that it's actually hard to get bitten by a shark.
Yeah, but it didn't work.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
You are talking to probably the only person in the world who's ever been attacked by a shark whilst dressed as a clown.
What?
Yeah, is one of the things that they wanted to test was like high contrast colors, like the science of a fishing lure, and that worked. I was attacked.
What?
And that was kind of fun. So
that
I was wearing.
Fun?
Yeah, I was. It was really interesting. So I was wearing chainmail, which chainmail suits, they protect against the lacerations of the teeth, but it doesn't do anything against the pressure of the bite. So the other thing that happens is when a shark bites you, they have serrations in the sides of their teeth, like a knife. And when they bite, they're sort of holding you like you would use a fork. So they bite down and grip, and then they move their bodies from side to side, and what that does is it
like
moves
knife.
The lacerations like a knife through, sawing through the flesh of whatever it is they're eating.
Oh my god!
In order to get a mouthful, but when you're wearing chainmail, that side to side movement means that almost always the links of the chainmail get caught in the teeth.
Right.
So then you end up with a shark attached to you.
Oh.
And what you have to do is very, very counterintuitive. You have to like hug the shark
and kind of
help it off.
Oh,
which when you're being bitten by a shark is not your natural reaction.
Oh really?
That's what we did. That was pretty special.
Is there video footage of this?
It was, yeah, of course. It was a Discovery Channel special. It was called How Not to Become Shark Bait. Probably
okay.
About 6 years ago now.
I want to. Well, I hope it's online. I'm going to try to find that and link to it so people can see.
Yeah, it may well be there.
Oh,
and what else? I did a special for the BBC a long time ago, where they needed somebody. It was a biology show, and they needed somebody that they could like mess with in pretty extreme ways. And they took me up into an extra 300. Light performance aircraft to see at what point I would lose consciousness through G-force. And that was pretty cool.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay. I love that you call these cool. How do you explain this to your young daughter? I mean, I don't know how old your daughter is, but how old is she?
She's four.
Oh, she's beautiful, adorable. Like, how do you explain this to her? And like, you can't really have like a bring your kid to work day. Like,
No, Millie's grown up with it. For Millie, all of this stuff is normal.
No.
It's not. You know, when we go into a theater and I'm doing fire, we have to do we have to do it for a fire marshal. We have to show them so that they can, you know, approve it.
Oh.
And usually, and I probably shouldn't say this in an interview, but usually we don't use quite as much fire in that demonstration as we do once the show's running.
Gotcha.
we don't want it to go. Actually, no, hang on a minute.
I don't think scary. Fire marshals listen.
I'm super safe with the whole thing, you know. But at the same time, these people tend to be a little officious, so we try and kind of on the side of caution,
right?
And usually, if Milligan, my daughter, is in the theater when we do that, she is almost always heckling. She'll be like, "More fire, Daddy!
No!
Come on, that's rubbish." Yeah, she gets it. She's grown up backstage, and
wow.
She's been around the world with us, and she's amazing. Actually,
are you going to bring her into any of your acts?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, she is a very natural performer, so I'm sure at some point she will go into some area of show business. Whether or not she actually stays there or not is going to be entirely up to her.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We'll see.
That's
we'll
really see. Cool.
She's only four. We got a long time.
She's adorable. I love seeing her on your Instagram. You. You have such a beautiful family.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you are. So your latest Broadway show, The Illusionist, is that what you're still touring?
Yeah, it's a different version. So there are three versions of The Illusionist. There's an internationally touring show, which I think is in Germany right now. And then there's the show that you saw, which is the period show, which is called The Illusionist's Turn of the Century, which is going to be touring, I think, next year. And then there's the original touring show, which is also done Broadway, and which I did the year before on Broadway.
Oh.
And that's the show that is touring America. And so that's what I'm doing right now. Yeah.
Wow. So the Turn of the Century, the one that I saw, turned out to be the most successful Broadway run of a magic show in history.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was very cool. It was awesome. Yeah, we did great business, and the audiences really loved it. The theater was fantastic. Could not have been in a better location. And also for that show, there was such a great, history and provenance to that theater, especially for me. You know, I'm such a big Houdini file, Houdini, really, when he started his career, he was like a hack magician. He did the same old stuff that everybody was doing, you know, card tricks,
mm-hmm.
you know, dove magic and whatnot, and nothing particularly original. But he bought the rights to doing a routine with handcuffs, where he would challenge somebody and escape from a pair of handcuffs.
Mm.
And that was not super common. In fact, there may have been only one other person that was doing that act at the time. And there was an agent. It was a guy called Martin Beck. And Beck was very savvy. And he said, look, forget the doves and the cards and all of that stuff. You should just concentrate on the handcuffs and the escapes. That's your thing. That's what you should be doing. And Houdini listened to Beck, and that's what he did. And he became the most famous man in the world, without question. At the time, the height of his career, he was hugely famous and successful. And Martin Beck built the Palace Theatre.
Oh, he was
an impresario as well as being an agent. Mm. And in vaudeville terms, there were different tiers, like circuits of theatres that worked together. And, you know, the higher priced tickets got the better acts. And so there were tiers of vaudeville circuits. And the top tier vaudeville circuit was the Keith Albee circuit. And the Palace Theatre on Broadway was like the jewel in the crown. It was basically the ambition. It was the highest place you could go in your career was to go and play a week at the Palace Theatre.
Wow.
And so it had all of that. It has all of that history. And so for us to put on Illusionist Turn of the Century there, you know, it really couldn't have been more perfect. It was fantastic.
And to have it be the, you know, most successful Broadway run of a magic show in history is amazing to even happen there.
Yeah, perfect. Amazing. Really. We were so blessed. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Have you seen, I assume, the Houdini like miniseries with Adrian Brody?
I actually consulted a little bit on it.
You know,
they called me up and I gave them some. I couldn't go. They wanted me to go to the set at one point and teach Adrian some stuff, and I couldn't manage it with my schedule. But I had long conversations with them about that.
Wow,
so that special. Yeah,
they kind of reveal some real secrets, you know, to magic. I'm surprised that was allowed because, you know, they showed how he broke out of handcuffs. Well, or at least one way he did it, right?
Yeah. And from my point of view, it is the least interesting part of the art film, especially escapes. And there isn't really a big secret to it. I mean, Houdini was operating in a world where he was really presenting what he was doing as a magic trick. You know, he would do it behind a curtain because he didn't want to be, he wanted to create a mystery behind what he was doing. And for me, I think, you know, that worked 100 years ago, but now I think people, I to be honest, I think if you're going to present an escape as a magic trick, I would be hard to come up with a worse trick.
Right. Well, now people call BS on everything. We're so skeptical. Well,
exactly. And so for me, my shtick is, you know, let's not make it a trick. We just do it for real, and explain to people exactly what it is that I'm doing. And you know, I go out of my way to prove that it's not a trick. You know, when I'm escaping from handcuffs, like I said, like you saw, I go out to the audience and I put those handcuffs onto the spectator,
right,
and I give him the pick and say, go ahead, try get out.
Yeah, you had him in there for like half the show.
Yeah, the first half of the funny. Show, there's a guy handcuffed. Yeah,
that was funny. So where can everyone go to find out more about you and see some of the clips and to find out where they can next see you perform? When will you be back in the U.S. after this tour? Do you know? Next winter?
Probably in the fall and the winter. The dates, we're constantly traveling. So in the U.S., if you go to my website, which is jonathan-goodwin.com, all of the tour dates are posted there. And we're really traveling everywhere. So there's a good chance, actually, that we'll be coming somewhere near
someone,
you know, wherever you are.
Yeah, I have plenty of people not in the United States, so maybe everyone can see you.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I try to be really good about updating that, and also social media as well. So just follow and click and do all that good stuff, and you'll be in the loop.
Yeah, keep you in the loop. Well, thank you so incredibly much for giving me so much time today. I know you have a show in a few minutes, right, or a few hours.
Yeah, we're in Dallas, Texas this week, and so it's our opening night here.
Oh, congrats!
We go up at like 7 o'clock tonight, I think. So I have a little bit of prep to do. I've got to go and sight some crossbows and stuff like that. But apart from that, I'm pretty good. So,
amazing!
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So cool that you just, you know, no big deal. I'm just gonna chill, sight some crossbows. I don't know, hang from my teeth, light myself on fire, and record an awesome podcast interview. No biggie. All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, Talia. All right, have a good day. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. I hope you're feeling well. I don't know. What are you feeling? I'm feeling like it's really interesting how everyone, if they allow themselves to dream, has such unique dreams. I mean, at age 7, he was holding his breath in a bathtub to practice his escape artist skills. At 7, I was putting on plays for my family in our living room. I guess I was practicing my speaking skills way back then, too. Anyway, take a note from Jonathan and make veggies your filler uppers. That is one of the best ideas I've heard in a while. And speaking of notes, the show notes from this episode, plus loads more inspiration and advice for living a healthier but not suckier life, resides at partyinmyplants.com/47.